Introducing Bluehost Cloud, ultra-fast WordPress hosting with 100% uptime. Want a website with unmatched power, speed, and control? Of course you do. And now you can have all three with Bluehost Cloud, the new web hosting plan from Bluehost. With 100% uptime and incredibly speedy load times, your WordPress websites will be dependable and lightning fast on a global scale. Plus, your sites can handle even the biggest traffic spikes without going down or lagging. And with Bluehost Cloud, you get 24/7 WordPress priority support, meaning you're connected to WordPress experts anytime you need them. Not to mention, you automatically get daily backups and world-class security. So, what are you waiting for? Get Bluehost Cloud today by visiting Bluehost.com. That's Bluehost.com.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to 1001 Heroes, Legends, Histories, and Mysteries. Some stories keep calling me to be written, and of them all, the story of the sinking of the RMS Titanic has been tugging at my sleeve for a long time. As I write this introduction, the date is April 12, 2019, 107 years, almost to the day, that the Titanic struck an iceberg in the North Atlantic, and that happened on Sunday, April 14, 1912. On this day, Friday the 12th, the 2,224 passengers and crew aboard the prize cruise ship of the White Star Lines were 2 days at sea on her maiden voyage, which had begun in Southampton, England, and now was headed for New York City. Many of you are listening to this first of at least three episodes on the night of Sunday, April 14th, and the morning of April 15th. Exactly 107 years after the unsinkable Titanic, the marvel of modern-day engineering, sank. Our Titanic story begins here with an author interview, which I will introduce in a few moments, followed by our story on the mysteries that surround the Titanic. Was the sinking foretold? And the answer is a definite yes, in many ways. And also, a multi-episode reading of a survivor's story, the book The Loss of the Titanic by James Beasley, which we're featuring at 1001 Heroes every Wednesday night starting this week. Check the show notes after this show for links. He began writing 1 week after the sinking, and his eyewitness story is incredible. This is a huge story to tell, and it contains hundreds of different smaller stories. Safer to say, thousands of stories, encompassing every category that this show covers: heroes, legends, histories, and mysteries. And I've waited a long time to do it, maybe fearing that I couldn't do this story justice with just one podcast. I think I was waiting for a sign. And that sign came to me from one of my favorite publishers, Regnery, a division of Salem Media Group, with a request to take a look at a brand new book titled The Last Night on the Titanic, Unsinkable Drinking, Dining, and Style by Veronica Hinke. My first thought was that the story was going to take a look at the rich and famous of pre-World War I Edwardian-era society. And I wondered, how can this book, the title of which promises to describe a lavish night of drinking and dining and style by what I thought was a chosen few, how could it possibly connect with the horrors of that tragic night and morning of April 14th and 15th as the unsinkable Titanic, after hours of human horrors, slipped beneath the waves, along with 1,503 souls. But I was soon to find that Veronica Hinkey nailed it perfectly with this book and this title, because on that night of April 14th, life was being celebrated. The champagne, drinks, and wine were flowing from the 12,000-bottle wine cellar aboard the Titanic. The incredible cuisine was being enjoyed, and on every deck, from first class to steerage, the passengers were having the time of their lives, sharing hopes and dreams for the future, joining in the merriment and festivities which the Titanic offered, and living life to the fullest on every deck. They had no idea what was about to happen in the minutes and hours after 11:40 p.m. on that Sunday, April 14th, when the Titanic's hull was ripped asunder by an iceberg. And if there ever was a window of time to history that we could enter to get a better understanding of 1912. The night of Sunday, April 14th, aboard the Titanic, was it. Why this time and place? The hours that comprised that day and that night are probably the most documented hours of the 20th century, having spawned countless books, articles, memoirs, documentaries, and movies, and the life stories and controversies that emerged from that tragedy have helped to secure the sinking of the Titanic as a timeless metaphor for disaster and heartbreak known round the world. The sinking of the RMS Titanic, which the best shipbuilders in the world said was unsinkable, also came to represent man's helplessness in the face of nature. The stories of heroism and sacrifice have become the stuff of legend. The mysteries involving the uncanny foretelling of doom for the Titanic are a story in themselves, and I will release that story as a single episode very soon. Today's episode features a very interesting interview with author Veronica Hinkey that helps us enter that precarious window in time by joining the passengers of the RMS Titanic at the dinner table as they enjoy life and hopes for a future that for many was about to change forever. Our slogan at 1001 Heroes is that we make history come alive, and Veronica Hinkey is going to help history come alive right now. We're very proud to have with us Veronica Hinkey. Veronica, how are you doing today?
I am great, John. I'm really looking forward to talking with you.
What inspired you to write The Last Night on the Titanic, and also tell us a little bit about your background?
Well, my background has a lot to do with why I wrote this book. I have a background as a features and food reporter, and in looking at the different chefs and home cooks throughout the years, it's always been one thing at the core of every story. At the heart of every story, John, it's about the people, you know, and learning about other things about them and their lives. In this case, there was just a great example of that throughout the book. So many different stories about these incredible heroes and brave people and just people that, you know, survived, and even the ones that didn't survive, their stories that they faced are just amazing. And we were able to tell those stories by looking at through the lens of culinary. And we include many different facets of style. We even look at music, flowers, home furnishings, fashion. But the real crux of this book is the food and the drinking, the cocktails, the champagnes, the wines. And we were able to include people who tucked away menus, people who wrote letters home. Like yesterday would have been the 107th anniversary of the letter that Adolphus Saalfeld wrote home to his wife after he boarded the Titanic at Southampton. He had this sumptuous lunch in first class, and he wrote to her about every detail of that lunch. So we were able to look at those things, and we extrapolated a little bit beyond, you know, where the menus, where there were gaps in, you know, all the details about all the different foods. We looked at restaurants at the time and what they would have been serving. So I went back and looked at recipes and menus from Delmonico's in New York City, for example, and from Antoine's in New Orleans, places that, you know, were also at the height of style during the Edwardian era.
That was one of my questions for you. Do you think the sinking of the Titanic had something to do with the beginning of the end of the Edwardian era?
Well, it definitely was a pinnacle for many people of, you know, the iconic sort of, you know, the time capsule that it shows us of what that life was like for so many reasons, because there was so much notoriety and news attached to it because it was such a horrible tragedy. And I think that, you know, what really happened later on was really a big part of it too. World War One was a huge factor in abolishing the class system as we have ever known it, and we haven't seen anything like it since. And I think that this was probably the most newsworthy thing that happened around that time period, or one of the most, probably the biggest news story around the world during those years. So a combination, I think it was just sort of like a many factors in combination that make the Titanic sort of a, you know, I called it a pinnacle of what life was like, the height of that lifestyle.
I'm hoping you can paint the scene for us to give us the style, the atmosphere, the music, and the energy of that last meal on the Titanic.
Well, you know, for those of who've watched the movie by James Cameron, the Titanic movie, he really nailed it. It was just a real festive environment in all the classes that night. And in each class, first, second, and third, there were significant things happening. There was a lot of gaiety, and especially in steerage and first class. And in second class, something really special happened. A group of friends, people who had become friends on their journey, not knowing that this would be the final night for many of them, and not knowing the amazing disaster that they would face within just a few hours, they wanted to have a hymn service. And it wasn't scheduled, John. It was something that they just wanted to do, and they got together and they asked Lawrence Beasley, who was a English journalist who was on the trip in second class, they asked him to, you know, ask the chaplain if something could be arranged for them. That's how devout these Christians were in second class, this group that got together. They really wanted to drum this up. They wanted to have a hymn service. And so many of the hymns were hymns that they sang that were, they had the same theme of what they would soon face.
Oh, that's amazing.
It was amazing. And the titles of the songs are included in the book. And so many of them are, it's just awesome to think.
Yeah, I was looking at the lyrics that you added to your book on songs like Autumn and Nearer, of course, Nearer My God to Thee, and the Navy Hymn. And then there were so many others where it was just prophetic.
Right. That's the word. Lead Kindly Light. That was one of the ones, like a green pasture song. That was another song that, you know, just was really almost foretelling of what these people were going to experience. So I just wanted to start with that because it was the most surprising thing to me. I hadn't known about the hymn service until I started researching for the book. And I think it's really important to really highlight what these people were like. That was important to them. I mean, we do want to focus on that kind of a thing as well. I think we'd be hard pressed to find an example like that in this day and age. I don't think you'd have people, you know, getting a hymn service together on a cruise ship like the Titanic. I maybe I'm wrong, but I thought that was really telling of the era. And then in first class, the real big story of that night was that there was a retirement dinner that only a handful of couples were invited to, even though it was in the midst of the first class dining room. So all around this private group, there were individual diners who were not a part of the party, but The retirement dinner was for Captain Smith. This was going to be his last voyage. If another incredible irony that I cannot believe that he was going to retire after he got back on this crossing. When he returned from the United States, he was going to retire. And so the Wideners of Philadelphia planned a beautiful dinner for him. And we don't know what was served that night, but we can imagine that it was likely a variety of things that are mentioned in the book. We do know that there was a lot of gaiety, as I mentioned earlier. Some described it as the height of gaiety on the trip. It was the most festive night of the trip. There were people standing up in first class, you know, reciting toasts to the Titanic, and it was just a very excited night. And around 9:30, 10 o'clock, most of the people retired to their cabins to go to sleep. Many of the male passengers went to the smoking rooms. In those days, women were not allowed. So it would be mostly, you know, it would be the men in the smoking room. So there were several people that were playing cards, sipping hot lemonade. They were, you know, sitting around drinking cocktails and hot toddies and nightcap, which were popular at the time. And when people were awakened, it was around 11:40 when the Titanic struck the iceberg. So that was when, you know, the tragedy began, was when they started loading the lifeboats. At first, there was a lot of hesitancy to board the lifeboats. People did not think that they would be safe in a lifeboat. They thought they'd be safer on the Titanic. So they even asked people like Violet Jessup, a crew member, a young gal crew member, they asked her to board a lifeboat so that others would be inspired to follow her her lead, and then they would start to board the lifeboat. So it was really hard. They were hard-pressed to get them filled, and that's one of the reasons that not all of them went out even close to full. There were a lot of instances like that. And when we look at the loading of the lifeboats, that's when we really start to see people take the shape of a hero. That's when we see people that are just incredible heroes in the face of death, even.
Would you share the story? It was a man and wife who both were invited into the lifeboat, and yet they ended up leaving the lifeboat, and she gave her coat to their maid who stayed in the lifeboat. Who was that? What couple was that? Ida?
That was, yes, good memory. Ida and Isadora Strauss of the Macy's Company. And this is a fabulous story for inspiration, and it's about love. And, you know, I think it would renew hope in someone who's ever been, you know, wronged in any kind of relationship about what the power of love and dedication with this couple. She, of course, is one of the wealthiest women in the world, one of the wealthiest women on the ship. She was offered a seat in a lifeboat. She was a first class passenger, and was ladies first. Ladies, women and children first. And so men stood down. Many men did. And, you know, even John Jacob Astor IV, probably the wealthiest man in the world at the time, did not get in a lifeboat. Even though there was a seat open, he could not take it. And Ida turned to her husband and she said, "I am not going. I love you so much. And if, you know, where he goes, I go," she said. And they stayed on the deck until the waves swept them away. Beforehand, she gave her fur coat to her new maid. She had just hired her new maid. And this was the first time they were getting to know her. She was traveling back from Europe with them. Now, years later, the maid tried to give the fur coat back to a daughter of the Strausses. And her daughter said, it was either a daughter or daughter-in-law, I think it was one of her actual daughters, she said, "No, my mother would have wanted you to keep this coat." You know, even knowing how much this coat would be valuable with the notoriety in all around the world about the Titanic, she said, "Please keep the coat." And I thought that was another example of demonstrating love and, you know, support for this woman, that she did not need to give her that coat, and she did not need to, her daughter didn't need to let her keep it. It's just a beautiful story.
Yeah, it was wonderfully written. Every page in your book, I find, is just a terrific story. And your book is so rare because it's a culinary narrative, and it ties everything together with the meals and the drinks. Tell us a little bit about Colonel Astor and his activities on the ship that night, and also how how certain drinks came from his efforts.
Yes, I love to talk about Colonel Astor because I did not have the full view of him before I started researching this book. John Jacob Astor IV was one of the most incredible men that ever lived. I used to look at him like, okay, he was, you know, I knew he was very wealthy, very powerful, and he went down on the Titanic. And then I started looking into this man and found out that he was an author of a science fiction novel, a published novel about everything that he foretold in the future. And that included things like, you know, video cameras and Maloev trains and all these things that, you know,
air travel,
solar power,
the whole deal.
Yes. And it was an amazing, genius work that he put together that I think he should be getting still today incredible credit for. He invented things like the street cleaner. I think it was one of the first street cleaners ever, and he had a patent for it. He was the first person to start using red velvet ropes to control crowds at big events, much like we do now at premieres and all sorts of different galas and so forth. And the red carpet that we talk about today so often was no doubt associated with the development of that, whether he was using red carpets at the time, but he certainly laid the groundwork for that whole approach of crowd management. He was the first person in New York City that I know of to strategically locate a hotel, in this case the Knickerbocker, inside an entrance inside a subway station. So, you know, it's kind of a known thing, easily known now, that hotel developers and other business owners will try to put their businesses as close as they can to, like here in Chicago, by an L station or a subway station. And that's sort of the, you know, ancestor of where that all started. He, to this day, you can see where the door is blocked in the subway station. Years ago, you could have gone right through that door into the Knickerbocker. So he thought of that. And then I included a couple of drinks that were invented at the Knickerbocker and the St. Regis after the Titanic, only because they're of the same general era. And I also wanted to highlight how his influence with the St. Regis and the Waldorf Astoria and the Knickerbocker, how his influence was carried out. Even, you know, they talk about, was the sink unsinkable? Is this, you know, they thought this was an unsinkable ship. And I start out the book asking the question, you know, maybe it was sort of unsinkable because those people's legacies live on. And the two cocktails I included to really underscore that are the Red Snapper and the which of course was the predecessor to the Bloody Mary, and the Perfect Martini, or the Martini as we know it today. And those were both invented later on at hotels that John Jacob Astor IV had started.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
You're John Chespagon.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Another incredible personality. In fact, we did a podcast story on her about a year ago. Was Margaret Brown, Molly Brown. And there was as you well know, there was a very famous stage play called The Unsinkable Molly Brown. Tell our listeners a little bit about her and how she ended up on the Titanic.
Molly Brown survived, and you know, as a woman in her day, she was not able to testify during the inquiries, and she just didn't let things like that stop her from doing amazing things. She still went on and ran for public office. You know, as far as demonstration of her bravery and her heroism, which was amazing on the Titanic, I like to think about what Mr. Rogers, Fred Rogers, shared with us after 9/11. He said that his mother had always told him, Fred, when there is a disaster, always look for the helpers. You will always find helpers, and that will keep you inspired. And Molly, in my opinion, is one of the greatest examples of the helpers on the Titanic. Molly set out afloat in a lifeboat in a pitch darkness. It was really hard to get into these lifeboats because some people had to jump at least a level down or sometimes two levels down to get into them. There were people jumping on top of each other. Some of the lifeboats were upended where the front end was higher than the other. And then once they were complete pitch darkness in freezing waters. So she encouraged the women in her lifeboat to stay warm by rowing. And that was her. She was a natural leader. When she got aboard the Carpathia in the next morning of April 15th, we're coming up on that anniversary on Monday, the 15th, of when the Carpathia rescued the survivors from the waters. She right away set to task organizing a group of course, mostly men at that time. I think it was all men. And she was one of the key ringleaders in organizing a group to acknowledge Captain Rostron and his crew. They gave him a cup. They were very ceremonious in it later on. They went back after many weeks or so after the disaster. But that was where they started culminating this whole honorary for him and his crew. And, you know, many of us might have been tempted to just cower in a corner and try to warm up and feel sorry for ourselves. And she took that and she transposed that energy into helping others.
Tell us the story, if you wouldn't mind, about you have some great recipes there for the head chef, Charles. And how do you pronounce his name? It's spelled J-O-A-G-H-I-N.
Charles Jochen, yeah.
Jochen. Yeah, could you give us his story? It's absolutely incredible, and there's some delicious recipes to put together in his honor. But what a story.
Well, you know, it is an incredible story, and I was so blessed to be able to connect with his great niece. She lives in New Jersey, where he ended out his days. And this story is, you want to talk about a hero. He was just incredible, John. I had seen depictions of him in movies, like the movie that James Cameron did, the Titanic movie that so many of us know and love. And we see Charles Jochen depicted in a baker's cap running up the poop deck with Kate Winslet. And I think everybody noticed that. And he's gone down in history as the man who supposedly survived by drinking. And of course, we all know now that that couldn't have been true. That couldn't have really happened that way. But he was drinking. He explained to the British Inquiry why. And it's actually an amazing story. Over the years, we've heard that he was drinking whiskey, and his niece was able to confirm for me that it was actually schnapps he said that he was drinking. And she also told me that he was a fabulous French pastry chef. So he was the chief baker aboard the Titanic, but, you know, just to get a job on the Titanic, especially during a coal strike was going on at the time, and so it was really hard to get a job at the sea. And Charles Jochen had been getting jobs on the ocean since he was a little boy. He was not able to go to school because he had to leave school to go to work on the seas full time. Can you imagine? You know, this little boy. And then he ended up learning how to be a French pastry chef, and he would make fabulous cakes, christening cakes and so forth for his family with beautiful blown sugar toppings. And he would make lovely chocolate eclairs he liked to make and mincemeat pies. And he was just a really great baker, pastry chef. And he got this job aboard the Titanic, like many of the staff. He had come from Titanic's sister ship, the Olympic. He had been on working on the Olympic. So he had had a few experiences in his career of disaster at sea, nothing like the Titanic, of course, but other near misses or close calls. And so he knew to check his lifeboat assignment. It was 107 years ago today, John, that Charles Jochen stopped in his bakery and looked at the crew assignments for the lifeboat and noted which lifeboat he was to man if there was a disaster. And sure enough, 3 days later, on that Saturday night when the iceberg struck at 11:40, he heard it. He was in his bunk. He was resting. He went up. He right away went to his checklist. He got his the bread loaves loaded. He got his crew up, got them to load the lifeboats with bread. And then he went to help load the lifeboats, to help get people into them. And when it was time for his lifeboat his assigned lifeboat to leave, he did not receive the command to board that lifeboat. Now, can you imagine knowing this is his only hope of getting off this ship? At this point, they know this ship is not going to make it. So that is when, as he told the British Inquiry later, that's when he went downstairs to his bunk to have a nip. And he might have had a jerry-rig still. A lot of the crew would have had stills in their rooms. As a baker, he would have had access to yeast, berries, and other fruits, plenty of different ingredients to do something like that. So then he comes back upstairs, and he sees that all the lifeboats are gone. And he looks at the deck chairs, and this is where I'm inspired. He says to himself, I'm going to throw all these deck chairs, these really like just lumbering, heavy deck chairs, I'm going to throw them into the water. And then maybe I'll have one I can hold on to when I'm in that water. And that's what he does. And then he's completely worn out from that, goes to have a drink of water. And then he notices that rush in the James Cameron movie of people running up the poop deck. That actually happened just like that. And he was swept up into that group. And then the waves carried him away. He tried to get on a lifeboat once he was in the waters. And he couldn't get on a lifeboat. He found one overturned lifeboat with just way too many men on it. He noticed a cook that he knew, and it was a cook by the name of Maynard. He held out his hand, and he held on to Charles's hand. And then a little while later, they heard somebody yelled, "We have room for 10 more." And he said, "Let go of my hand." And he swam over to the lifeboat, and eventually he made it on the Carpathia. When he got on board, he said he was so frozen. The water was so cold. He had tread water for 2 hours, even though he said his hair didn't even get wet.
Now the water was 28 degrees, right?
Right.
And he was wearing a waist belt vest.
Yes, and he said that it helped him so much that he didn't even get his hair wet. And then he said they popped me into the oven like one of my own pies. And he told his nieces and nephews later that he knew it was an iceberg because he saw a polar bear and it waved at him.
Yeah, always telling the story without the horror, right, to the little ones after.
Yes.
And
can you imagine how would you handle that when you have little ones that are looking up to you, and you have to tell that story? It's just remarkable.
Yeah, it's an incredible story. And he suffered further tragedies, did he not? I believe his wife died in childbirth.
Yes, his one wife died, and then he remarried and was living in New Jersey when she passed away. And if, believe it or not, you know, for years after the Titanic, he went back to the only job he ever knew. And he was at sea for many years after the Titanic.
When it comes down to the final moment, there are no classes. There are only heroes. Who, in your opinion, were the real heroes?
You know, the first person that comes to my mind is Archibald Butt, who was the aide to President Taft. And time again and again, we heard stories of how he would help ladies get into the lifeboats. And one of the ladies who was also there on the ship from Washington, D.C., like Archibald Butt was, but they didn't know each other. I don't think they knew each other very well. But she recalled that he got her into the lifeboat and tucked a blanket around her, and she said it was just like he was getting her ready to go on a motor car ride. And that was really touching to me, because I thought, here this poor man knew his fate. He knew what was going to happen to him. And he still found the strength to tuck a blanket around a lady that was going to probably survive. Or maybe he didn't know what would happen to her. And, you know, he really did feel protective of her. But I think he was a gentleman to the end in a way that, you know, is definitely inspiring to us.
What was the story about the lady who was out in a partially filled lifeboat, and because they were afraid that they were going to get sucked in by the downward spiral of the ship and the vacuum created there, they rowed further out rather than going in to pick up people who were still treading water, and she had offered the people rowing that boat money. What was the story on that, and did she get that reputation unfairly?
Yes, definitely. And that's one of the things I was happy to be able to feature in my book. That was Lady Duff Gordon, Lucy Duff Gordon, and her husband, Sir Cosmo Duff Gordon. And they were from London. She was a fashion designer, one of the most, you know, prolific fashion designers of the day. And recently, some letters were found in the attorney office in England, the attorney that represented them, that have vindicated them of all claims. For years, this poor couple was scorned because they were accused of offering money to the crew that were rowing their boat to row faster and row away from the Titanic because they were afraid of the suction. That was a huge concern to all of these people in these lifeboats, was the suction when the Titanic finally went under. When in fact, what we find out is that they were just doing what anybody would have done. The lifeboats were sent out not completely full in many cases. And in their case, that was what happened. They actually gave money to the crew when the crew told them, you know, we lost our jobs tonight. I was going to make X amount of money on this trip and then come back. And now I'm out of work and there's a coal strike. So the Duff Gordons were trying to be kind and they were trying to be generous. And somehow out of the nightmare of that night, that got twisted and they became demonized for trying to do something nice. And I think that's a good reminder to all of us today, not to jump the gun on here. If you hear a story like that, you know, don't always assume that what you hear is the truth.
That's a great lesson. What's the lore behind the Bronx cocktail, and how is it made?
Oh, well, the Bronx cocktail is just one of my favorites because, well, first of all, it was invented at the Waldorf Astoria, which was the hotel that was owned by John Jacob Astor IV, and of course, his cousin. And the Bronx cocktail I love because it has a little orange juice in it. And I have a little back and forth going with Frank Caiafa, who is one of the contributors in the book, and he contributed a few of the Bronx recipes. And he loves to just have the snap of the orange peel and a little bit of orange flavor from that, whereas I always love mimosas, so I like to add a little bit of orange juice, and I almost think of it as a, you know, a sort of a more of a serious mimosa. It's like a kind of a martini with a little orange juice in it. And I love the story of how it was invented. The story goes that somebody created this new drink at the Waldorf Astoria. And when they asked what it would be called, the person that was trying to think of a name had just been to the Bronx Zoo. And they thought of how, you know, when people drink too much, they sometimes become like the animals at the zoo. So that's the story of where the name comes from not necessarily the borough, the Bronx, but the actual zoo.
In your book and already in today's interview, you've discussed the author Lawrence Beasley. I found Lawrence Beasley's book on the Titanic, since he was there and he was a survivor. And he started writing that account, I think, just about a week, actually, after the sinking. I noticed in your book that you refer back to it a number of times. It's an excellent account. I wanted to ask you what bit of knowledge he shared, if you can recall one that you thought was your favorite, unknown to you, piece of knowledge.
Well, I'm going to go back to that hymn service. He was really instrumental in making that happen because he was a prominent person in second class, very well known at the time. And I just think that's so neat that they spun up that hymn service just, you know, of their own volition. They just wanted to do that. And he was a really key component in letting it happen, or helping it happen, I should say, because, you know, they kind of knew that the chaplain would listen to Lawrence Beasley if he asked about it. And then, you know, Lawrence Beasley didn't say no. That's another lesson I learned in researching this book, is the wonderful things that can happen by saying yes. You know, he said to them, yes, I'll ask if it's okay if we have this hymn service, and I'll get it organized. You know, so many times we hear no these days, and I think seeing that from a perspective of someone like Lawrence Beasley, you know, making someone's dream happen that night, I think is pretty profound.
What was the story of the orphan children? I think one was maybe five or four, and the other maybe two.
The Navratil twins.
Yes. Could you share that story?
Yeah, sure. Well, for a long time, there were two babies, but no one knew who they belonged to. And the story still isn't straight, as for sure. But it ended up being a situation where a man had taken his children, and he was going through a divorce. And so that's why the children were separated from him. During the sinking, they were in a lifeboat, and it was just sort of a real strange experience for people, you know, wondering, where did these babies come from? And that's pretty much the crux of that story.
Yeah, the older one couldn't speak English, so they, as I understand,
right.
And it took them a long time to figure out what had happened.
Right. I should have mentioned that he couldn't speak English. They were French. And imagine how scared those poor little boys were.
I'm going to go back to the passengers for a second and ask you, what were some of your favorite passengers and passenger stories aboard that ship, and why?
I love the story of the man from my hometown. I grew up hearing about a man named Daniel Coxon, who was a popcorn vendor, and the town that I grew up in. I lived in the town for a few years, and then actually grew up in Wausau, but he was in Merrill, Wisconsin, which is in north central Wisconsin. And he was a popcorn and peanut vendor. And there's many reasons I love this story, aside from the fact that he's from my hometown. I don't know what happened to him after he boarded the Titanic, but he was born with a shriveled arm. His left arm was, you know, not strong and functioning as it could have been. And so he was questioned by authorities. It would have been yesterday, 107 years ago on the 10th, when he boarded in Southampton with his brother and his nephew. And in the inquiry later, the brother of Dan Coxon explained how he got held up because the British officials were asking him so many questions. They were really, you know, ironing him through because of his arm. And yet he never let this arm slow him down. He was a professional to the end. He was a businessman throughout north central Wisconsin. And it's one of my favorite discoveries of this research that I did. I found a letter that he wrote to, at that time, a very well-known journalist. Actually, he was well-known in the 1930s. He became well known around the world as H.V. Kaltenborn. They call him the Walter Cronkite of radio. Many people refer to him like that. And at the time the Titanic sunk, he was the dramatics editor at the Brooklyn Daily Eagle. And on the 17th of April, 2 days after the Titanic sunk, when headlines around the globe were dominated by the disaster, he received a letter from Popcorn Dan, that said, I'm coming to visit you. I'm on the Titanic. I'll be there on probably the day the letter would have gotten there, around the 17th. And I'm looking forward to staying with you in Brooklyn. And HV, the next morning, went running into his boss's office, and the letter was printed in the Brooklyn Daily Eagle that day, or the next morning. So I love that story because it's about two men. HV Kaltenborn was also from my hometown, and it's about this friendship of these men who, you know, were going to meet up after the Titanic landed and docked at Chelsea Piers in New York City. And I think that's such a neat story.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
There are so many stories, and listeners out there, I'd like you to know there's so many stories in this book that our conversation today barely scratches the surface. But it's informative. It's a real window to history. And it just makes it fascinating because there's so many great stories here. You shared your favorite passenger story. What's your favorite crew story, a member of the crew?
Well, my favorite is the Charles Jochen story by far. But I also love the story of Ed Wheelton, who saved a handwritten crew menu. And that was really helpful to me because I wanted to be inclusive of the crew and, you know, all sorts of different menus, not just the one first-class dinner menu that everyone has celebrated so much, especially since the Rick Archbold and Dana McCauley book, The Last Dinner on the Titanic. It really set the spark for people around the world to recreate that last first-class dinner. But I really wanted to expand and show a variety of different menus. And the Ed Wheelton handwritten crew menu was amazing. And also the sea trials menus. You mentioned the plover, and that was served on April 2nd to the crew after the sea trials. There were sea trials on April 2nd and on April 3rd. And on each day, they had a fabulous meal. And one of the meal items on the second was the plover. And I thought that was really neat and telling about the crew and the chefs that they thought to have a seabird. Plover is a seabird. And it was a wonderful way to honor these men who had dedicated their lives to working on the sea.
You know, there were three classes on that ship, first class, second class, and third class. My wife always tells me I have no class. And when I looked at the menus from the top to the bottom of the ship, I actually, if I could have, I would have gone down to third class and eaten there. I absolutely love some of the items that they were enjoying down there. Could you kind of explain the difference between the meal offerings between first class, second class, and third class?
Sure. Like one of the things we see in third class is tripe, which is the stomach of a cow, and it's cooked down in the recipes that we include in the book. It was just tripe and onions on the ship, but we've got these more doctored up recipes in the book. We sort of did a study on tripe with a couple of different recipes from contributors around the world. And it turns out this is a fabulously honored recipe in many families. These turned out to be heirloom recipes that I was able to track down. And so tripe is really interesting. There's also the gruel that was on the third class menu. And just the sound of it today, I think, you know, it definitely must have taken on a whole different connotation over the years, because for that to be on a menu now, it would be unheard of, you know. But at that point, it still had not received such a, you know, bad reputation, and it was on the menu then. And we see buckwheat cakes, real hearty foods, boiled potatoes, all sorts of different jacket potatoes were in all three classes. And when you hear the phrase jacket potatoes, that's really just a baked potato. So, again, we think of the way things are called then versus now. And you gave an example of that earlier of, you know, we would never think to call something a certain way. And back then it was real common. So, and then we look at first class, the extreme opposite, and all of the oysters and canapes, lobster canapes, and, you know, salmon mousseline. And it was the height of French culinary because the White Star Line commissioned an Italian entrepreneur by the name of Luigi Gatti. He was on board as, he was not on board, but he had commissioned these outposts, these French restaurants that were not associated in any other way with the White Star Line. So they brought in a whole bunch of different staff from all over the place to staff that those French kitchens. And in fact, that was one of the reasons why many of the cooks were not able to make it out, because they weren't considered White Star Line staff or passengers. So during the British inquiry, there was at least one headline that ran that said that Titanic cooks drowned like rats because they were held back.
Mm. Could you describe Boris, one of the most powerful, well, there were a lot, but one of the ones that really impressed me was the eyewitness testimony of Captain Edward Smith's last moments. Could you describe that to our listeners?
At least one eyewitness testimony places Captain Smith as a gentleman to the end, swimming out to a lifeboat with a baby. And they did not know, because you have to imagine it was complete pitch darkness. They were even lighting the tips of ropes to try to get some kind of light. They would use their, you know, matches for their cigarettes to light the ropes and try to see that way, but it was complete darkness. But they do believe that it was Captain Smith that brought the baby out to the lifeboat and then was offered a seat, and he declined, even in the water, if that account is accurate about what happened.
Incredible. I'm going to get to the major debate that a lot of people have, especially researchers in the same class as you who have gone over testimony after testimony. And I guess I could paraphrase that by saying, and the band played on. And you know what debate we're approaching, do you not?
I sure do. And the debate continues on that. You know, and I hoped I did a really thorough job of showing the different eyewitness accounts. And one that I think of, the one that I think, you know, is the most convincing to me is Edith Rosenbaum Russell, the famous fashion journalist of the time. She was returning from Paris after the spring fashion shows. And she said, well, heavens no, they wouldn't have been playing Nearer My God to Thee, because that would have discouraged the passengers. And, you know, they would have wanted to uplift them. Like, for instance, John Jacques Hume, the first violinist, ran into Violet Jessop while he was dashing off to go and play after the iceberg, and after the Titanic struck the iceberg. And he said to her, we're just going to cheer folks up for a little bit. We're just, that was clearly their mission. Violet shared that later, that Jock had said to her, you know, we're just going to go try to cheer folks up for a little bit, which makes sense to me too, that they probably weren't playing Nearer My God to Thee. And as far as playing to the very end, they probably played as long as they could, and they certainly did play for a substantial amount of time. So we know that the band was playing during the loading of the lifeboats, for instance, and very close to the end. But what they were playing, you know, the song Autumn that you mentioned, that was one of the songs that people thought they heard. And, you know, that song alone is sobering enough when you think of the idea of autumn. It's really more about a romance, but just the thought of autumn might be a little hint at some more sobering music. But as far as, you know, Nearer My God to Thee, I would have to say, in my own guess, Edith Rosenbaum Russell probably has a good point there.
What was your favorite movie? Was it 1955? Night to Remember, or was it the James Cameron version? What was that, 1995?
That is the toughest question I've had on this whole book tour.
Good.
I cannot. Oh my gosh, that I could not pick. Which I just love them both. So
both your heart out.
Yes. Yeah. And I'm a real fan of old film. I you know, so many people are, like the TMC crowd. I love old film. I really appreciate it. And even though sometimes scenes can seem a little hokey, you know, or you can tell it's something's really obvious. And we've really been able to iron out a lot of misnomers from, you know, the original accounts and so forth that were put together. And so even that too, there's not everything's dead on and so forth, but I still just love that movie. And of course, who doesn't love James Cameron's Titanic movie? I mean, it's just, you hear the music and you just can't think of anything else. Did wrap everything around that romance, because as I saw in the research I did, there were quite a number of blossoming, budding romances, and people, it happens when you get on an airplane today, you know, you kind of, I know just through the years, it's always been kind of a place where people meet and you can, you know, see people flirting. And I mean, it's just, travel does that to you. And so there were many cases of these blossoming romances.
There are also stories of imposters and swindlers and con men aboard. Can you share any of those with our listeners?
Well, as I mentioned earlier about the blossoming romances, there was one case, a woman named Kate Buss, who was traveling by herself. And, you know, throughout the different letters that I read and the different eyewitness testimonies, it was very clear that a man named Dr. Morawek was trying to get to know her in a romantic way, and it wasn't very welcomed. She had made it real clear to him she wasn't interested, and she wanted to spend time with her friends that she had met aboard the ship and new friends she had made. And it turns out that this man, you know, Kate might have been onto something. She might have noticed something about him, because as it turns out, Dr. Morawek, who did not survive the disaster, was a man who had swindled innocent, unsuspecting widows out of their estates more than once. In fact, the headlines read after he perished on the Titanic that his greed and his, you know, in his inheritance didn't serve him well at all, because he was literally on the Titanic because he was returning from a trip where he was going to check out an estate he had inherited from a woman. And he had swindled it away from her family, her children, and he was trying to decide what to do with this villa. So he had gone over to, I think it was Germany, to visit the villa. And on his way back is when he passed away on the Titanic. So as you can imagine, reporters of the day had a field day with that, with headlines about, you know, here he is, you know, coming back from this swindle deal, and he, you know, experiences this disaster, which, of course, would, you know, not be something anyone would wish on anyone at all, but it was me there. And apparently he had done this with several unsuspecting widows.
What can the student of history take home from your book?
Well, you know, I hope that this is a book people can read and they can feel uplifted. Even though it's a story about disaster and trial and tribulation and horrific experiences, these people were the wind beneath my wings while I was going through some of the most trying experiences of my personal life. My mother passed away suddenly and unexpectedly, and a few months after that, I was diagnosed with triple negative breast cancer. And I still had the book to get done, and I still had my job and everything else going on, other concerns. And someone reminded me, you know, when I was going through reading these people's terrible stories and writing them, you know, putting them together into this book, a friend said to me, it's no that you're working on this book right now. because these people are keeping you strong. They're providing you inspiration, and they did.
How very true. Courage, heroism, love.
Yes.
I mean, it's all there. Bravery. In huge doses.
I mean, to read a quote from Dr. William Minahan of Green Bay, Wisconsin, who said, as he was getting his wife and sister into a lifeboat, he said, be brave. No matter what, be brave. And I would, you know, read that while I was working late at night, sometimes, you know, way past midnight. And how can you not be inspired by that?
First of all, I want to tell you how much I've looked forward to this, and that how much I've loved the chance to talk to you about this book. It is inspiring. You're right. And there's so many more stories in here. And I encourage all of our listeners to get a copy of this, The Last Night on the Titanic. It's out right now in hardback by Veronica Hinke, H-I-N-K-E. And Veronica, could you tell people how they can get in touch with you and how they can find your book?
Well, I'm on Facebook. I'd love to keep in touch through Facebook. I'm on Instagram and Twitter at Foodstringer, all together with no spaces or anything. And then you can purchase the book online at Amazon, Books A Million, and Barnes & Noble. It's also available in bookstores everywhere now.
Well, I know it's going to do extremely well, and I hope I get first shot at your next one, because I know there's going to be more.
Well, I really appreciate being able to talk with you, and it's been a joy.
Thank you so very, very much for sharing your time with us today, and we all wish you the best of luck in your personal life and in your author life. And it's been an absolute pleasure having the opportunity to speak with you and to share you with our listeners. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, listeners, what a great person. What a great, inspiring story. I hope you all order a copy of her book. You're going to enjoy the drink recipes, the food recipes, and the story behind the story. And keep your eyes open for more episodes on the Titanic from 1001 Heroes. We're doing one called The Mysteries of the Titanic, which should be out soon. And another one is a multi-episode series based on Lawrence Beasley's book. And he was a survivor of the Titanic, and he wrote an excellent book. So kind of think of the next 2 weeks as Titanic weeks, and we're going to cover that story from top to bottom. Thank you so much for joining us. Please take time to send us a review if you enjoy our show. We would appreciate that very much. And thanks for listening. We'll see you soon.
Credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.